You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Heineken Silver. When you discover something you love, like a new podcast or beer, you have to tell everyone about it. So when you try new Heineken Silver, a world-class light beer with only 2.9 carbs and 95 calories, you'll want to tell the world how great it is. New Heineken Silver, the world-class light beer with all the taste, no bitter endings. Available at your local Heineken retailer or for delivery at heineken.com/silver. Must be 21 plus to purchase. Enjoy Heineken responsibly.
Hello.
I'm Howard Dory.
I'm Jess Dory.
And welcome to Plotting Through the Presidents, where we dive into lesser-known stories from American history, usually related to presidents, and sometimes interview historians and authors who know way more than I do.
But you know plenty.
You're right. The only reason I have historians on is so that I can ask questions and they can say, good question.
Does that fill your bucket?
Yeah. And then I move on to the next question. I don't even let them answer.
Well, I think is it...
I just wanted them to hear my good question.
Yeah.
Last week, we teased that this episode was going to be about Andrew Jackson's role in Indian removal. That's actually going to be next time.
Oh, you're waiting on that one, huh?
Waiting a little bit. Today, I'm excited to share an interview that is about a much more modern, by our standards, subject.
Modern, interesting.
Yes, I talked to Paul Sparrow. He has an impressive past. He was a TV producer, journalist. He helped lead the museum in Washington, D.C., and then he served as a director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum.
Wow. You love library people.
I love libraries. It's true. They're good people. So Paul Sparrow has a fascinating new book out called Awakening the Spirit of America, FDR's War of Words with Charles Lindbergh and the Battle to Save Democracy.
Wow.
And that's just the title.
That's just the title.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of fascinating things loaded up in there.
There's a lot of titles in one, but yeah.
You can do that with a colon. I've learned from you. If there's a colon, you can make your title as long as you want it to be.
That's true. That's true. Colons can do amazing things.
Okay.
I was really enthralled with how what's happening now is echoed in what happened in the late 1930s and early 40s during World War II.
Yeah, this is a different leap for you, but I don't think we have any other episode like this.
No. And I've been thinking about World War II lately, because there's been a lot of talk lately about democracy and threats to democracy and fascism. And I think about what it's meant in the past to fight for and preserve democracy. And I know I told you this at the time. I think about how it was 7 years ago now that I was at Pete's Coffee Shop in Studio City, and I met a 93-year-old veteran of the Second World War. He had like a veteran hat on.
Yeah.
He was an old man. I was proud of who he was and didn't mind advertising it. Someone started a conversation with him, and then suddenly he was just kind of regaling a group of us that were sitting around with stories from his past.
That generation in general, their stories are especially riveting.
Yeah. It was incredible. Like he talked about how he was a medic on one of the first three boats to land at Okinawa. He showed us a picture that he took with a camera that he was not supposed to have.
Oh my God.
Of Hiroshima just weeks after the bomb was dropped.
Oh wow. He just had this picture on him?
I think he had it on his phone.
Okay.
A picture of it on his phone.
Right.
He said that when he returned from war, he suffered from PTSD, even though they didn't call it that back then. So badly, I guess, that he tried to kill his mother in her sleep.
Oh, my God.
And later, his wife. Yeah.
Are they okay?
I'm pretty sure. He said he tried.
He tried.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So he would have night terrors of some kind.
Yeah, basically. I think he would think he was being attacked or... Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really terrifying.
Yeah.
For all involved.
Definitely. I remember he said nonchalantly that all his friends are dead. Most of the Jewish boys like himself from his neighborhood, he said, never even made it back from the war.
Oh, gosh.
Despite all that, though, he was one of the happiest, friendliest people that I've ever met. He talked with pride about his daughter, who now runs his business. He talked about his granddaughter, who used to be his grandson. He talked about how important it is to never fully retire.
Uh-huh.
Because he says that's when you die.
Wow. So he's 93. Was he there alone or did he have a caregiver, or he was just like out and about at a coffee shop at 93?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's really impressive.
He may have been driving. He seemed pretty savvy and with it.
Yeah.
There was a tank outside, so that might have been. But yeah, he talked about just all kinds of stuff. And he said that he took a trip with his wife around the world after the war. And he talked about how much he loved Japan and New Zealand, but he didn't care for Europe. Like the whole continent, apparently.
Right. All right.
Didn't cut it.
Well, you know? I mean, I went on this European trip with my family, including my grandfather, who was in the infantry in World War II. And, you know, seeing things through his eyes as we were traveling around, it's very different than just your typical tourist.
Yeah.
Because you're reliving the horrors of your lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, he'd seen the world, and he knows the horrors of war better than most people alive today.
Yeah.
And what struck me, what I was thinking about recently, is that he clearly remembered what he was fighting for and what he was fighting against. Mm-hmm. Like, it was very clear to the people fighting that they were fighting for democracy and freedom, and they were fighting against authoritarianism and fascism. And this vet at the coffee shop, this was in 2017, he had strong feelings about the president at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Who was Trump. He couldn't wrap his head around how the country could have elected someone who he thought didn't value American democracy the way that he did. Mm-hmm. He considered it like a slap in the face to what his generation sacrificed. But it reminds me of a John Adams quote from 1777. "You will never know how much it costs the present generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you will make a good use of it." Hmm. And I don't know if that man is still alive.
I know. He was 93, and this was how long ago?
7 years ago. He'd be turning 100 this year.
Wow.
But it makes me think of how we're losing the people who fought that battle.
Yeah.
There's not many left, like people who experienced World War II and the Holocaust firsthand. And I think that because of that, we don't feel it as much in our collective bones anymore, mm-hmm. like we used to.
Right. There's a sense of taking it for granted.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not as vigilant about preventing those things as we were.
The vigilance has decreased.
Yeah. And that's one reason that I'm glad that folks like Paul Sparrow are writing about it in ways that make it feel real. So let's take a listen. All right. Paul Sparrow, author of Awakening the Spirit of America, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard. I'm excited to be on it.
I'm excited to have you here. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not a World War II guy. I've seen a lot of the big movies. You know, I know how it ends. I know the broad strokes for sure. But I never really dived into books about that period. And I have to say that your book it's riveting. It's really a great introduction to FDR and the United States at that time.
Thank you.
I'm curious, how did you come to decide to tell that particular story?
Well, you know, I worked as the director of the FDR Library for a number of years, and I became deeply impressed with his persuasive ability, how he was able to help Americans overcome their resistance to different things, especially in the beginning years of his administration with the Great Depression, all these New Deal policies that, you know, he was accused of being a communist and a socialist and everything you could imagine, and introducing a radically different approach to what the role of the federal government was. And he had to convince people and convince the public. And he was able to do that through very effective use of language and media, you know, radio, newspapers, speeches. And as I looked at the scope of his presidency, I mean, the first draft of the manuscript I wrote covered everything, you know, from 1933 to 1945. And, you know, all the publishers rejected. They said, it's too broad. You know, you need to focus on something. And then this period to me is the most interesting because it was his greatest challenge in terms of, you know, massive public opinion in opposition to what he was trying to do. You know, isolationists in America were at about 70% or so in 1939 when the war started. And he was up against these very, very powerful figures in Congress, in business, Henry Ford, William Randolph Hearst, Robert McCormick, and of course, then this celebrity hero of Charles Lindbergh. So he really had to raise awareness And he put together this fantastic team of speechwriters to help him craft this message in what was literally the fate of the world hanging in the balance. If America wasn't prepared and didn't get involved in this war, it really looked like fascism was going to stamp out democracy.
Yeah, I want to talk about the America First movement. Now, who were they and what was their purpose?
Well, it's an interesting story. It's a little complicated. People don't fully realize America First started out on campuses, Yale and Harvard and East Coast campuses, as basically an anti-war movement, not unlike the college movement in the 1960s against the Vietnam War. And there were a number of very liberal people who were involved. Sergeant Shriver, Justice, went on to become head of the Peace Corps, and Potter, who became a Supreme Court Justice, and Gerald Ford, and people who were concerned about the idea of America getting involved in this foreign war. Then as time went on, it became taken over by real anti-Roosevelt, anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic, pro-Nazi factions. And so a lot of the original people who were involved in this sort of faded away. And then in 1941, they sort of turned to Charles Lindbergh to become their primary spokesperson. Initially, he had been a little skeptical. He didn't want to get drawn into any organized group. He wanted to be able to have the freedom to speak for himself. But he eventually became their spokesperson, and all of the other isolationist movements sort of rallied around America First.
I didn't realize until reading your book that even members of Congress were actually fed talking points from a German agent that was basically coming from the Nazis. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely, because it's very fascinating. The Germans had actually started a misinformation campaign during World War I to turn America against the Allies. And George Viereck, who was the German agent in World War I, was still in America and became the number one German agent, recruiting politicians, recruiting senators and congressmen, Senator Lundeen from Minnesota, Burton Wheeler, who was actually a Democrat from Montana, Hamilton Fish III, who was a congressman representing a district in Hudson Valley that was actually FDR's home district. There were overall about 20 members of Congress who the FBI identified as having been directly involved with this scheme. And the idea was that if a congressman gives a speech on the floor, or a senator, that material is automatically public domain, so there's no copyright fees. And congressmen and senators have something called a franking privilege, which allows them to send out unlimited amounts of mail for free. And so the Nazis would write the propaganda, give it to these congressmen, they'd say it on the floor, they then send millions of postcards and letters out with a Capitol Hill return address from what appeared to be their local congressmen, which were strictly either deliberate misinformation about the Roosevelt administration and its policies, or pro-Nazi propaganda. And so people didn't even realize that this massive misinformation campaign was going on.
You want to think, oh, nothing like that could happen now, surely. But you see how talking points maybe from Putin's Russia make its way into Congress today.
Oh, that's exactly the same. And this idea of foreign interference in elections is nothing new. It's been going on for hundreds of years. The United States was involved in this dirty tricks campaigns with the CIA in the 60s and 70s, particularly in South and Central America and African nations, where they would try to make sure that the politicians who were sympathetic to the Soviet Union were denigrated or misinformation campaigns, or they were blackmailed. So this has been going on for a long time. I think what Putin has done, both in England, in Europe, in the United States, is he has weaponized social media in a way that we had never seen before. And so therefore, you didn't need franking privileges of congressmen. It was going right into people's social media sites and with these made-up characters that you would believe, oh, this is a mailman who lives in one town over, and look what he's saying. If he's saying this, it must be true. And of course, it's just a bot that was created by some hacker in Germany or Russia and is being used to feed misinformation or deliberately using content that would divide America. They would take the most inflaming issues, whether it's abortion or immigration or the border, and they would ramp it up to this 11, as they say in Spinal Tap, turn the volume all the way up to maximize the outrage, to maximize this crisis as the two parties split and people began living in these information silos where they only heard information that reinforced their worldview, and they oftentimes felt that it was coming from a more reliable source than the mainstream media, you know, their uncle, their cousin, some mailman, a former veteran, you know, and of course it wasn't. A lot of it was just being fed to them by algorithms and bots.
Remember how we talked about the John Adams diet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of hard work.
Eating chocolate?
No. The growing your own food, the pulling out of the ground, wiping off the dirt. Who's got that kind of time?
How lucky are we to live in a world where we can get Factor?
Fresh, never frozen meals that are dietitian approved and are ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
I love the cheesy bacon ranch shredded chicken that got me through some really hard work days.
How is this healthy?
I don't know, but it is. It helped me maintain my wellness goals this year.
Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon.
And the most delicious sauces. Head to factormeals.com/plotting50 and use code plotting50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month.
That's code plotting50 at factormeals.com/plotting50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Hello, listeners. This is Anne Bogle, author, blogger, and creator of the podcast, What Should I Read Next? Since 2016, I've been helping readers bring more joy and delight into their reading lives. Every week, I tackle all things books and reading with a guest and guide them in discovering their next read. They share 3 books they love, 1 book they don't, and what they've been reading lately. And I recommend 3 titles they may enjoy reading next. Guests have said our conversations are like therapy, troubleshooting issues that have plagued their reading lives for years, and possibly the rest of their lives as well. And of course, recommending books that meet the moment, whether they are looking for deep introspection to spur or encourage a life change, or a frothy page-turner to help them escape the stresses of work, school, everything. You'll learn something about yourself as a reader, and you'll definitely walk away confident to choose your next read with a whole list of new books and authors to try. So join us each Tuesday for What Should I Read Next? Subscribe now wherever you're listening to this podcast and visit our website, whatshouldireadnextpodcast.com, to find out more.
Yeah, I think about how public values have changed. And one thing that really struck me, I believe it was Charles Lindbergh's wife in a book that she wrote, actually said that maybe democracy's time was over and that totalitarianism might be the way of the future. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how that went over?
Sure, because as when Lindbergh reemerged from his sort of self-imposed isolation in 1939 and did his first radio broadcast after the war started, and started taking these very anti-Roosevelt positions, pro-isolationist, anti-interventionist, you know, there was a lot of pushback. You know, a lot of people were harshly critical of him, and his wife wanted to try to defend him. So she was a highly regarded, award-winning author, best-selling author on her own account, and a pretty fascinating woman, a pilot and a navigator. And so she wrote this book called Wave of the Future, in which she postulates that, you know, fascism and totalitarianism are the wave of the future, and democracy is an old, tired system that doesn't work, and that, you know, the Nazis were just the scum on the surface of this new wave that would eventually be blown off. But this new form of government that's a strong, powerful central leader is the wave of the future. And then, of course, she was shocked when there was tremendous pushback against that. It's one of the few times you see Franklin Roosevelt really directly criticize something. He says in one of his speeches that there are those who feel that totalitarianism is the wave of the future, but I believe democracy is still alive. And so, yeah, it was sort of shocking. It was a bestseller, but it was also one of the most despised books of that year. So, you know, when you look at this combination, she was very pregnant when the book came out. And so she was sort of shocked, and she sort of pulled back and had a baby and sort of stayed in the background. But then she wrote another article responding to all the criticism, in which she basically doubles down on her idea that totalitarianism is the way of the future.
Going back to FDR, You talk about him being the perfect president for that time. Can you talk a little bit more about what made him perfect for that time?
Well, it was a combination of deep knowledge of military history. He'd been studying naval history since the time he was a child. He was very interest in the projection of naval power. He'd been the assistant secretary of the Navy during World War I under President Woodrow Wilson. So he knew how the Navy worked, and he had been trying, you know, to increase the size of the Navy, as he had tried to do prior to America's entry into World War I. So he was fairly successful at that. It was much harder. Americans didn't like the idea of a standing army. The navies had more support primarily because one of the reasons Americans felt good about being isolationists was they felt they were protected by these two oceans. You know, we have friendly neighbors on the north and the south, and we're protected by these two oceans so that no one can ever invade us. We're safe. And so the Navy would protect us, whereas the idea of a standing army was really anathema to most Americans, which is why we had so few soldiers. We had less than 200,000 soldiers when World War I erupted. So that idea of how do you build the army up was one of, again, his great leadership accomplishments, was that he just gradually found every possible way he could to provide support for England, give them the desperately needed weapons, let them fight the Nazis for now, while we built up our army and instituted a peacetime draft and built more planes and shifted our industrial might into weapons manufacturing to become, as he said, the great arsenal of democracy. And this was his key strategy, at least initially, and how he could sort of get around the Neutrality Act and American isolationism was to say, we're going to make the weapons and give them to them, and they're going to fight the war. So we're protecting our most precious resource, which is young lives.
Now, it sounds like isolationism was very much the rule of the day. He slowly chipped away at that, but there was still this opposing faction of America First and several members of Congress. But then Pearl Harbor changed everything.
Right. So over that year, so the war starts in 39, September 39, and then in May of 1940, the Germans sweep through Europe and France falls and England is the only country left standing. And then Germany invades the Soviet Union in June of 41. So there really is this sense of just crisis. And as time goes on, between FDR's sort of constant nudging and history lessons and his effort to awaken the spirit of America, as I call it, more and more you see the polls shifting ever so slowly. So more and more people are supporting initially the idea that we should provide weapons and aid to England, but not get involved in the war ourselves. And then as the atrocities start becoming more obvious and the persecution of the Jews and the concentration camps, and then the stories about the mass killings, all these things really started to affect Americans. And you start to see the shift in public opinion so that by, you know, late October, early November of 1941, you know, for the first time, you're seeing a majority of Americans who are supporting the idea that America is going to have to get into this war. FDR never wanted to get in front of public opinion. You know, he was being constantly pressured by Churchill and by his military leaders. You know, we need to declare war. You know, Churchill's going to fail. If he fails, we'll never get back to England. But FDR felt that he couldn't declare war in Germany, that something had to happen that would change the American opinion. Now, he thought even after they sank a couple of our ships and, you know, did the, I mean, it basically was a war going on in the North Atlantic. It really wasn't until Pearl Harbor that the entire country united behind this idea that we need to fight. We need to be willing to fight for freedom everywhere in the world and protect other people's freedoms as well as our own. There is no hiding place.
Do you think anything like that could unite the United States today?
Well, certainly historically, you know, wars have brought Americans together. You look at what happened at 9/11, you know, there was a brief moment at least where America really came together and felt this unified mission of trying to get justice, you know, for what had been done to us. You see it less in the Korea War, but you certainly see it in World War One. You see it less in the Vietnam War, because again, that's where you start getting younger generation challenging the assumptions of the power structure that says, you know, it's okay to bomb civilians and napalm villages. And, you know, we had to destroy the village to save it. That whole concept was very hard to justify morally. You know, in World War II, we were fairly successful at having the moral imperative on our side. We were the good guys. And then suddenly, you know, particularly in the Vietnam War, yes, there was a geopolitical reason for us propping up this corrupt government in South Vietnam, but really there was no moral reason for us to do what we were doing there. And that was where you first really start seeing the country not coalescing around its leadership in time of war. I do think that there is an opportunity for America to come back together again. I'm very Rooseveltian in my beliefs. I'm optimistic in that the American system will work. Winston Churchill famously said to his generals, Americans always do the right thing after they've tried everything else. So, you know, there is this sense that we're struggling right now. We're a deeply divided nation, not the first time. And we're struggling with these sort of core issues of who are we as a people? You know, FDR strongly believed that we are a people who are willing to fight for freedom everywhere in the world, that everyone should have equal opportunity, that we should welcome immigrants into our country, and that we are a nation of laws, and that the most important component of American democracy is the idea that every person has a right to vote. Every citizen has a right to vote.
Thinking about isolationism then and today, it seems like the best parallel I can draw is looking at the war in Ukraine and whether to arm the Ukrainians and the fights in Congress over that. How does that debate mirror what was going on in Roosevelt's time, if it does?
Well, it's almost identical. If you look at Zelensky as Churchill, obviously Ukraine doesn't have, you know, the British Empire to fall back on. But if you look at Putin as Hitler and Zelensky as Churchill, the parallels are quite similar, where you saw Hitler reaching out and taking the Sudetenland and then Austria and then Czechoslovakia. And then finally, before he goes into Poland, he had been, you know, gradually acquiring property and testing to see, you know, would the Allies step in. Putin did the same thing in Georgia and Crimea, you know, and other places where he was exerting his military force and taking territory through military force, and the West didn't respond. You know, nasty letters and, you know, angry statements and ineffective sanctions. And so I think he really believed that he would be able to come into Ukraine, just like Hitler believed he was going to be able to bomb the British into submission and then invade the island and take over the British Isles. And in the same way that Hitler was shocked at the effectiveness of the RAF and their newly developed radar systems and the fact that his bombing did not break the spirit of the British people, I think Putin was equally shocked that the Ukrainians were able to muster such a ferocious defense in their country and that their belief in their independence was something that he just didn't understand. And then I think he was doubly shocked, and I think he'd been probably given false information by his inner circle, never want to, you know, say anything that he doesn't agree with, that the Europeans would step up and the Americans would step up and protect the Ukraine. I mean, this, however you feel about Trump politically, there's no question his sympathies very openly lie with Putin. And he did everything in his power to undermine Ukraine and to take Putin's side. And so I think you saw, you know, Trump playing the role of the pro-Nazi isolationist in the lead up to World War II, and essentially nudge, nudge, wink, wink, giving him the, you know, the green light to go ahead. You know, we're not going to interfere.
What's the danger of American isolationism regarding Ukraine today? If we were to say, you know, that's not our fight. That's not America. That's not us. Let them figure it out. Putin's not a threat to us. What's the danger in that kind of thinking?
Well, do you want to live in a world in which there are rules of law that every country has to follow? As soon as you say, well, it's okay for Russia to invade the Ukraine and take over that country militarily, because once upon a time, Ukraine was part of another, you know, a Russian-based empire. So therefore, it's fine. Then that means it's fine for China to go into Taiwan. You know, it's fine for Rwanda to go into Rhodesia. You know, all of a sudden, all of these, you know, simmering, you know, international conflicts that have been sort of tampered down can erupt anywhere. And that's the biggest issue, is that the structure, the international structure with the United Nations and the International Criminal Court and all of these structures were put in place to prevent another world war. And world wars start with one country invading another one, and then the dominoes fall as the allies on each side get involved and the war escalates. So if you allow Putin to take over the Ukraine against their will, you are essentially opening that Pandora's box that says, well, any country that's more powerful than its neighbor can invade and take over that country.
Thinking about a couple of other characters in the book that certainly played a role, can you talk about Eleanor Roosevelt for a moment and her unique skill set during this lead up to the U.S. involvement in World War II?
So Eleanor was very concerned about the obsession and focus that her husband had on the international situation and his willingness to compromise some of the core New Deal gains to lure manufacturing and lure the tech and the industrial giants to supporting the development and the expansion of our armaments industries. And so she was very concerned about this. She had a big part to play in the Fair Employment Practices Act, which made it illegal to discriminate against blacks in the military industrial complex, which was being developed as part of the arsenal of democracy. She also was very effective in helping keep the coalition together, the Democratic coalition together. You know, one of my favorite scenes is that when FDR decides he's going to run for a third term, breaking George Washington's great tradition of stepping down after two terms, you know, they acclaim him the candidate at the convention in Chicago. And then there's this crisis that breaks out because he wanted Henry Wallace to be his new vice president, who was a very liberal, you know, New Dealer with had a lot of baggage. He'd been his agricultural secretary for the first two terms. And the party leaders really didn't want, they wanted somebody much more conservative and much more controllable. So the convention just descended into chaos. And Franklin, who was in Washington, calls Eleanor, who's at her home in Hyde Park, Valkill, and says, you know, Eleanor, I need you to go to the convention. And she really didn't want to go, but she went. She flew there, arrived 10 o'clock at night. You know, there's literally fist fights on the floor. And she sort of walks out onto the stage. And she's not really announced properly. People don't really understand who it is at first. And suddenly, as the delegates realize that that's Eleanor Roosevelt walking out on the stage, this sort of silence descends over the hall. And the mood sort of starts to shift. And as she gives this remarkable speech, which she's essentially improvising. She had a half a page of notes, but it gives this incredible speech where she makes the point that this is no ordinary time. The world is on fire. The president of the United States has to make very, very difficult decisions. You have to give him the tools he wants, meaning the vice president, so that he can take on this extraordinarily difficult task. And she sort of just transforms the convention, and they approve Wallace as vice president. And, you know, of course, they go on to win the election. And it shows the deep respect and love that the party faithful had for her and her ability to be a voice of reason, of the conscience of the party, you know, some might say. But she really is a unique figure in American history. There's just no other woman who plays the role she plays before entering the White House, during the White House years, and then, of course, you know, for almost 20 years afterwards, the extraordinary role she plays in civil rights and women's liberation and the transformation of post-war America.
Yeah, and she had a weekly Sunday night radio show where she would speak to the nation?
She had a Sunday night radio show. She had a 6 day a week newspaper column, sort of an early blog, where she would talk about, you know, I went to the museum today and I had lunch with my friend and my son James was home for the holidays. And oh, by the way, it's really important that we support, you know, integration in our public schools because segregated schools are unfair, you know, all in one, you know, 800 word column. But she did that for, 25 years, 6 days a week. And her radio broadcast, of course, after Pearl Harbor, which took place on a Sunday, she was the first member of the administration to speak to the American people because she had a 6 o'clock radio broadcast. So she goes on. FDR and his advisors didn't even ask to see a draft of the speech. She just goes and gives this really extraordinary address where she says, you know, to all the women out there, I want to tell you that I have four boys who are all in uniform and I have no idea where they are tonight. And, you know, the fear clutches at your heart. And it's just a remarkable moment where she's reaching out as a first lady and trying to calm the country down. And then, of course, the next day, FDR addresses Congress with the famous Day of Infamy speech, and his leadership takes center stage. And at that point, you know, he takes on the mantle of command and begins the transformation of America from an isolationist country to a global superpower. Mm.
You mentioned that the original draft of the book was much, much longer. What was the most painful section or through line to cut for you?
Well, interestingly, the hardest part for me was cutting Eleanor out, because in the first version, I looked at both of their speeches and their efforts, and Eleanor, in her own way, was incredibly effective, but she was effective, you know, with slow incremental changes over time. You know, FDR would make these big dramatic speeches with this, you know, powerful imagery, arsenal of democracy, rattlesnakes of the Atlantic, you know, you have nothing to fear but fear itself, rendezvous with destiny, you know, he had these big ideas, whereas Eleanor was much more about the decency and respect that every human deserves. And so her speeches are fascinating to look at because they had a cumulative effect over time. She was just so consistent and she developed this enormous following. So it was difficult because she does not play as big a role during that period, 39 to 42, as she did in the earlier years of the Roosevelt administration. And, you know, I'm a huge Eleanor fan. They had a very complicated and some might say dysfunctional, you know, marriage. But as political partners, they were incredibly effective.
Now, something that I've asked other historians that have, you know, been kind enough to come on the show, and this is based on the fact that President Biden had a summit of historians at the White House at least once. If you were invited to some kind of summit at the White House to address the challenges of today and given the opportunity to directly give advice to the president, what would you say?
I would say believe in the American system. The American system has been tested in the past and has almost failed in the past, but I think the American system is designed to withstand tremendous shocks, which is what's going on right now. We have a crisis of faith in our system. Huge swaths of the American public no longer believe in Congress or in the rule of law or in the Supreme Court. And the pendulum swings back and forth, you know, it swings from one extreme to the other. And you have to believe that the system will self-correct, and that you have to be true to who you are. People elected you for a reason. You said you were going to do certain things. Do those things.
What do you hope readers get out of your book when they read it?
Well, I hope that they will both understand the relevance to today, that these are parallels that you can't ignore. But I really hope that they will understand the reason Roosevelt was so successful was both his masterful use of language and media, but also his unfailing belief in the American system, his optimism, his confidence that things would be okay. You know, his first inaugural address, the famous line, "The only thing you have to fear is fear itself." And he's talking about the banking crisis. And he proved very quickly that a lot of the banking crisis was hysteria. And if you could get the people to believe that the system was going to work, they would stop trying to pull all their money out. And in fact, they put their money back in. And so I think that's the one message I want to take, you know, be like Roosevelt, believe in the system, get involved, and understand what the spirit of America really is. We are a nation of immigrants who believe that everybody should have equal opportunity. Not everyone's going to have equal success, but everyone should have equal opportunity. And I think that those are fundamentals, willingness to fight for freedom, the understanding that we are a country that is a shining beacon to the rest of the world, and we have to accept that responsibility.
Thank you so much for your time, Paul. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Howard.
Okay, wow, that was pretty powerful.
Right?
And talking about current events, you know, I get passionate about the stories you tell, but when we're talking about current events, it just, there's a level of like nausea that comes over me because it is so real and impactful for our current state. You know, it just makes you realize so many things, like how fragile everything is.
Yeah.
Then You know, learning about Eleanor Roosevelt was really mind-blowing. You know, I don't know much about her at all, being someone who's never really studied history. But I, you know, after hearing him speak about her, I find her to be such a fascinating figure.
Yeah.
I mean, truly. Which I'm sure everyone already knows, but I, you know, I'm just kind of developing that thought. So yeah, it was very thought-provoking and I appreciated him very much.
Paul Sparrow's book is out now, Awakening the Spirit of America. I think it serves as a great introduction to the world stage of the time of World War II and how the United States slowly got involved in it. Thank you for listening. You can find out more at plodpod.com. If you like what you heard, please spread the word. Follow us on your favorite podcast app and consider joining our Patreon family for fun bonuses like an even longer version of this interview with Paul Sparrow. Mm-hmm. So thank you for plotting along with us.
Thanks for plotting. Bye.
Winston Churchill famously said to his generals, "Americans always do the right thing after they've tried everything else."